Welcome to Mug Bite. I'm Gavin Clark, software editor for The Register.
And I'm Mary Jo Foley, editor of the ZDNet All About Microsoft blog.
This show, we're at Microsoft's Mix conference in Vegas, where we're getting the sights, the sounds, and the smells of Halo 3 and Gears of War coming through loud and clear. But somehow a fitting backdrop for a week that's seen Azure go down and maybe Microsoft's cloud becoming self-aware and deciding to declare war on the whole human race. Who knows? This show, what happened? We had no Steve Ballmer, but we had plenty of Bill Buxton talking about the importance of experience and interface and design, three things Microsoft's never been particularly good at as far as many people are concerned. We had Dean Hashimovic, General Manager for Internet Explorer, and we had every developer's favourite, Scott Guthrie, the VP of .NET developer platform, talking about Silverlight 3, which released a beta. We're going to be getting into some of those in this episode of Microbyte. And also, we'll be talking about Azure, 22 hours of darkness. What happens next? Are the clouds learning? Are they testing our defences? Are they becoming self-aware? So, MJ, I don't know what you thought about Silverlight 3 out of the browser in Adobe's face. What did you think of that?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, Gavin. I mean, it wasn't too unknown what Microsoft was going to announce here at Mix. Everybody figured they were going to have some kind of a test release of the new version of Silverlight out. I thought it was interesting that they said here at the show that this is the one and only beta of Silverlight 3, that there isn't going to be any more, and the product's actually going to be out this year, which is what we had kind of heard hints about before, but it seems like it's almost like a whole new Microsoft. Like, they're actually shipping things when they say they're going to ship them and only having one beta. It's a real departure for them. So that's one thing that struck me from Scott Goo's remarks, in addition to his blinding red shirt, of course. That was a big theme here. A lot of people wearing red on the first day of Mix, trying to have a little fun with Scott Goo wearing his red shirt. The part of Silverlight 3 that I was the most interested in, and I'm interested to hear what you think about this, is the whole out-of-browser piece of it. It's almost like they announced it as an afterthought in the keynote. It was kind of like the keynote was almost over and suddenly, and we've got one more thing kind of thing, almost like an Apple, you know. And they, to me, that was one of the most important features, because basically what it's going to let you do is if you download the Silverlight 3 runtime, you're automatically going to be able to run Silverlight 3 applications outside the browser, which means on your desktop. So that's pretty big deal. You know, it's Microsoft doing a catch-up thing with Adobe Air, I feel like. But, you know, of course, they're portraying it as we're not really emulating Air. We're doing things our own way. We're not, you know, we're using a sandbox metaphor for the security so that you won't be served up with a security prompt, and that'll make for a better user experience with with Silverlight when you use it out of the browser. So that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I thought they definitely glossed over the experience, the whole Silverlight out of the browser experience. They diligenced us with a lot of facts, checkbox list of features that said they've now got this, and then they've got that. And in many ways, it was filling a lot of holes that they'd had up against Adobe with things like back button support and clear type, improved graphics, the ability to add shading to things, some real basics. But then they also went into some important new areas, and this was one of them that you just mentioned. I think there's a temptation for us to kind of maybe pick up on the most exciting, the most innovative stuff, especially in an environment where everyone's obsessed with web services and rich internet applications operating outside the browser. But I don't think it did Microsoft a whole lot of favors in just squeezing this one thing in at the end, and they certainly glossed over it. Now the question is whether they don't know quite what to do with it, or whether they just want to put it out there and see how people pick up on it.
Yeah, I asked them when I had a chance to talk to some of the execs who were part of that announcement. I asked them a couple things that I saw come up in some of the tweets I was monitoring from the show. And one question that a few people have had is, so if you can run Silverlight out of the browser, does that mean the end of Windows Presentation Foundation? Like, is that does that basically signal that Microsoft's going to back away from that and that you won't need WPF anymore? And their answer to that is pretty predictable, but somewhat believable too. They said, the kind of app that you would run outside the browser in Silverlight is probably a simpler app, more like something like you'd use it for a viewer almost, instead of an app that really needs to directly interface with the operating system or the PC hardware where you're running it. So they're kind of categorizing things and saying, you know, if you have a lighter weight app, something simple, something probably more consumer focused, you might look more at running Silverlight out of the browser. But if you're trying to build a line of business app or something that really requires interaction with the registry and the operating system, or something that's going to involve big databases or heavy duty tables, that you're still going to go and develop a true rich WPF app.
If I may, I think that's possibly wishful thinking on Microsoft's part, and it's certainly a lack of vision on their part. That smacks of them defending their territory. They don't want to give up the desktop and acknowledge the fact that once you let Silverlight run outside the browser, essentially you don't really have a need for the desktop operating system anymore, but you do have a need for the local storage and the local computing resources, and that way you're moving towards this virtualized desktop. So once again, Microsoft is a victim of its own business strategy, which is to protect the desktop with Windows or Office. I mean, you wouldn't hear Adobe talking about, oh, you're only going to use Air to build lightweight applications. As far as they're concerned, they want to push this thing all the way, and they want to completely disintermediate the desktop experience and things like Windows.
I saw an interesting post today from Ryan Stewart, who works at Adobe. He actually used to be a blogger at ZDNet too, and he was talking about how he thinks it's not a fair comparison to put Silverlight outside the browser up against Adobe Air, because he feels like what you're describing is true, that Adobe Air is like the new development paradigm and the development environment for all kinds of apps. And I think Microsoft is trying to do what they did with software plus services in a way. They are trying to protect their territory, but they also, I think, are recognizing there's different kinds of apps, and that there are different tiers of apps and different needs for different levels of apps too. So I kind of do buy into that, because we were talking as an example about Office 14's web apps, you know, and I said, well, why don't you guys just make those, you know, Silverlight apps and run them outside the browser? And the guy who I was interviewing, I'm trying to think of his name now, but I can't. He was one of the guys on the team for Silverlight. He said, yeah, why don't you ask the Office team that? And, you know, his answer was, you know, you still are going to want to run something like full Office as a rich client, and you're not going to want to run that in a browser or even in the out of the browser mode in Silverlight, because with Office, you're going to have big tables, you're going to have big databases, you're going to rely more on interacting with the operating system. But he said it wouldn't be far-fetched to do something like an Office 14 web app as a Silverlight app. So they're definitely saying it's like a continuum. You know how they say software plus services, and users are going to want them all. They're going to want to run some software on the desktop and some in the cloud. I think they're trying to make that same meta apply with WPF and Silverlight. And, you know, it's hard to remember, but Silverlight's actually is like the spawn of WPF, right? Those two things were really one. And that's when Silverlight used to be called WPFE. So it's not that far of a stretch. I think maybe the way to think about it too is Adobe and Microsoft are coming at the market and from really different places. So maybe we're not really seeing an apples to apples comparison with Silverlight 3 and Air.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, there's a lot of differences between both of them, and you know, there's a tendency to look at this at a very high level. I think it's interesting though that Microsoft is not being as evangelical on this as they can, and they're doing that for political reasons, and wishes they were got to protect the Windows franchise. I mean, you know, this hits to the heart of the issue, that when people look to companies for innovation these days and evangelism and inspiration, they're not looking to Microsoft, they're looking to the companies that are challenging the Microsoft Microsoft desktop, such as Google with its online apps, or Adobe, because those companies haven't got anything to lose. So Microsoft is, in a way, is dampening its vision, downplaying its vision, because it's got all this like baggage of a history and technology investment that it fears that if it kind of like, if it takes everyone to a lightweight future, it's going to lose all its investment and its business revenues on the desktop. An interesting thing also, I mean, it raises the question, what does Silverlight 3 out of the browser mean for the browser? Internet Explorer 8, which we're going to get on to, that was released finally at the show. And it raises the question, if you're going to have applications running out, the web applications running out of the browser, at what point do you need the browser? Obviously, you're going to need it to get online for that very first online experience. But the ultimate vision, as people at Sun are talking about and Adobe are talking about, is that once you've got your web services-based application running on your desktop, it can then live locally and it can put in the local data, and suddenly you completely again disintermediate the browser. So in some ways I'm taking it to an extreme there, but in other ways and it would be like, you know, browser for cases or browsing to suit the site you need or the service you want. But take it to its logical conclusion, though, you're looking at a world where if everyone's running apps outside the browser, you're going to need Internet Explorer just to get online. And after that, well, when do you need it after that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it kind of, you're bringing up a point that's really interesting. Like, what does the browser of the future even look like, right? That's a whole other can of worms. And one that Microsoft didn't want to touch this week, they really didn't want to talk about anything beyond IE8, as you would kind of expect, since it's their launch week. But when I asked them about what is the technology that makes the Silverlight outside the browser work, what it really is a mini browser in a way. You know, it's they call it outside the browser, but it's a host. There's like an encapsulated shell that's hosted on your desktop. So, you know, it's not what we think of as a browser today, but maybe that's the browser of the future. Like, I don't think the idea of a browser will go away. So that's one interesting point. A place where I see this being really useful to Microsoft and users too is netbooks. Because, you know, like if you're thinking about, so what, you know, if you don't have a hard drive on your netbook and you need to access all these little apps, wouldn't it be awesome if you could just like have these little kind of disposable apps that you could run on your desktop, and when you don't need them anymore, boom. You kind of blow them away. Well, that's one of the things you can do with this Silverlight 3 outside the browser implementation.
What did you get from the tweet streams coming out of the show? I didn't actually pick up on those in regards to Silverlight, but what was the grassroots reaction to what people were seeing?
Yeah, people were excited about it. You know, I think it felt almost like a PDC when Microsoft first announced Azure. People were kind of trying to get their head around it, like, you know, what does this mean that Microsoft's doing this, and what can I do with that technology? So I don't think a lot of people have really thought through the implications of what they could do with Silverlight outside the browser, you know, because there are, you know, we were talking earlier about this, there still aren't that many developers really dabbling with AIR yet either, you know, so it's still kind of a new concept, and I think developers are just starting to think it through. But you know, it's going to come pretty quickly if they really do get Silverlight 3 out this year, and it'll be interesting to see what kinds of showcase apps people do. Like we saw one here at the show, the KPXE radio station app, where, you know, you're listening to a program and then you get on the bus with your laptop and you can finish listening to it because you've already streamed all the content onto your laptop. So
I think a critical factor in all this will be how the partners pick it up. I mean, those companies have been kind of dying for some kind of interface development environment for ages. They've been stuck with Forms and ASP.NET, but it's never really matched up to the power that people have found in Flash. And so often when it comes to going to customers, the customers will use them so far for a server-side app or a desktop app, but when it comes to the actual interface, the partners can be cut out of the equation because the customer can default to Flash, which is one of the big industry standards when it comes to interface development. So I think Silverlight 3, where Silverlight 3 goes as far as out of the browser, as far as rich interface goes, that's going to come down to what the partners do with it and how they work the angles, and they see a way of making money out of it as ever. And that's how Windows became so successful. People work the angles.
Yep, definitely. Yeah. But that's a great segue into the browser. Since we've been talking out of the browser, let's talk back about the browser.
Indeed. Now, I thought it was interesting. I kind of, to my mind, I capsulized the story around Internet Explorer 8, which is released finally at Mix, as the search for legitimacy and the hunt for downloads. I thought it was interesting that Dean Hashimovich, he couched his presentation at the show purely in terms of the amount of data they'd done and the amount of research they'd done to justify how they'd redone due diligence on delivering the perfect browsing experience. You never hear that kind of stuff from Mozilla or Google. They just put a browser out there.
Yeah, you know where you do hear it, though, which is interesting. You hear it from the Windows 7 team.
Yeah.
And, you know, Microsoft's getting really big on, like, using data to back up their case. Like, you know, oh, everyone says we're not as fast. Well, let's do a survey and we're going to show you we're just as fast as Chrome. I mean, they're really trying to do things where they talk about how much user data they get and how all the different numbers they can point to. Like, we've got more CSS 2.1 case studies than any other browser, you know. So I think that's one strategy, but how much are users going to care? I think, you know, an audience like here, you know, developers might care, they might not, but everyday users, I don't know if they even know what a CSS case study is, you know, or data only takes you so far. Like when Microsoft talks about the, you know, millions of customer records or how many, you know, for saving 40 people a week from a malware infestation because of the new anti-phishing capabilities in IE8, you know, that sounds good, but it also, I don't think, shows people as much as just let's get the browser on the desktop and see how it works compared to like what we're used to, like Firefox or another browser.
And I mean, that's Microsoft model, it seems, and it shows to me how they're coming up with a message that's wrong for the audience they're trying to reach, which is they produce white papers and comparative data research, which is great. Well, that's Microsoft aims that kind of stuff at IT buying managers, people in marketing, whereas the people they should be reaching out to are the developers who don't give a toss for like white papers and like marketing research and like comparative study. They just want to get their hands on it, and they'll do their own benchmarks and they'll do their own studies, and then they'll come to their own conclusions about whether this browser is fast enough or whether it's clean enough or whether it's secure enough. So to me, it seems like Microsoft is fighting the wrong battle or using the wrong weapons to fight this battle as far as all these messaging and like benchmarks and standards and white papers are that they're putting out at this show and we can expect more of. I thought it was interesting you raised the point on CSS 2.1. More than 6,000 CSS tests they've done just to prove they're compliant with the standard. Again, it's this whole hunt to prove the search for legitimacy. And Dean was going on at the show, he was talking about, you know, we are committed to standards. You know, they don't want there to be any question left in people's minds that this is the future. I don't know, I actually checked a few tweet reactions. It was actually interesting. One guy tweeted, when he saw Dean say we're committed to standards, he tweeted ROFLMAO, which is rolling around on the floor. Oh, I believe. So yeah, people weren't taking that one too seriously. Other people were complimenting on Microsoft on cherry picking stuff that made IE look good. Other people said they were doing a scare job on Firefox. And one thing that was interesting was the whole new sandboxed tab browsing experience, which some people said Chrome has had that already. And then I spoke to Dean afterwards, and it turned out that that sandboxed tab environment will only go up to 3 tabs. Once you get over 3 tabs, then it's going to start sharing. Browsing experiences and instances. So again, this whole secure, resilient browsing experience has definitely got its limitations.
Yeah, you know, I keep coming back. It seems overly simplistic, I think, but I keep coming back to the two things that I think most people are going to judge IE8 on. And one is speed, you know, which is what we've seen in a lot of the reviews that have come out this week. People really focusing on, is it really faster? And is it fast enough to win back a lot of the losses they've had to Firefox and to a lesser extent Chrome and Safari? And for me, the one that's even bigger and more important is the compatibility issue, which, you know, they definitely talked about that here at Mix, but I keep coming back to that is that's going to be what makes or breaks IE8 to me. I think as people start downloading it, you know, everyday people, not people who've been beta testing it like us, but people who haven't even tried it yet and they use IE8 and they go to some site that may or may not be on the compatibility list, probably may not, you know, some kind of specialized site, some like little small business site where they optimize that site for like IE6 or IE7 and it doesn't work right in IE8. The average user isn't going to know what's going on. They're going to like say, oh, IE8's not working. They're not going to know that it's the site that's not working. You know, we talked about this on our last podcast too. And I think, I've been running all the different versions of IE8 as they've come out and, updating my compatibility list as I could, you know, to see how things were performing. And I put the final bits on my machine today. They fixed a lot of things even between the release candidate and now. Like there are sites that weren't working before that are working now, but there still are going to be all these little weird one-off sites that people are going to go to, everyday people, you know, who get the browser and they're just, I think, going to be surprised when, even if it's not a major thing, it's not like the whole site isn't going to load, but, you know, something doesn't look right on the site, something doesn't line up, or, you know, if you go to some weird travel site and you can't print your boarding pass, you know, it's like, I think people are going to run into those things, and I think that's where we're going to see how well or poorly IE8 really does, and it's not going to be about CSS case studies and test suites and, you know, benchmarks.
And it's hard to imagine Microsoft would be so generous on any browser compared to that came out with a browser that didn't render every single web page online properly. I mean, I met up with Amy, now I can't pronounce her surname, Barzudkas, and I'm sure I'd like hash that one up. But, sorry, Amy. She was saying, well, you know, BBC, CNN, even Microsoft.com, at domain level, they work. It's sub-pages within the site. But come on, this is the web. People's tolerance for failure is very small. And there's no way, again, Microsoft would be so generous if Firefox like worked at a domain level, but there were sub-pages within that domain didn't work. They'd be like laughing at a browser that did that. They'd be saying, this browser is not ready and it's not serious competition to Internet Explorer.
Yeah, and again, here, you know, the problem too is users don't know who to blame. Actually, the fact that IE8's breaking these sites isn't quote unquote Microsoft's fault in a real sense, because they are dependent now on the developers tweaking their sites to work with IE8. Like, Microsoft's done as much as they can. They've tried to tell developers, come on, guys, fix your sites. Here's your choice. You can add a meta tag to your site to make it work, or we're going to put your name on this compatibility list, and we're going to send you into a default mode and not put you in the standards mode. So I feel like Microsoft's done everything they can. Because they broke the standards in the past, the developers aren't really jumping over themselves to hurry up and update their browsers. Like, I know one webmaster I talked to recently, I said, do you know your site doesn't work right with IE8? And he said, well, I'm not going to touch it until Microsoft ships IE8, because I think they're going to keep changing the code to the last minute. And, you know, they've done this to me before, and I'm not going to let them do this again. And then he said, and I don't even know when they're going to ship it. And I said to him, I thought they were going to ship it soon. And he's like, yeah, what do you mean, like a year or two from now? So it's like all the past old Microsoft behaviors are kind of coming back and haunting them on IE8.
I'm going to, before you get like an avalanche of hate mail saying you're a Microsoft sympathizer for saying Microsoft's done all it can, a lot of people, I met Opera's CEO a few weeks back. Basically, there's a lot of people out there who've got no sympathy for Microsoft, who basically feel it's got itself in a situation of its own making. And frankly, they couldn't give a damn. They want to see Microsoft to go out there and fix every single site or come up with a solution that takes the load off these web developers. And that whole compatibility standards view mode is only prolonging the pain. They should have like shot this thing in the head and then moved on. And I spoke to Dean, and I said, when do you think we'll see an end to this whole compatibility and standards joint mode? And I got a feeling, and realistically speaking, and I think he said, like, ideally we'd like to, but ultimately, you know, there's always legacy out there. So the feeling is we'll never see an end to this dual approach to viewing. And just one other thing I noticed about Internet Explorer, to your point about can you trust Microsoft, they introduced web slicers, and we all know what Microsoft's history is on introducing new features into products, so they're not supporting them and killing them in the next version of a product. Anyone who buys into web slicers then finds and bets their business or ad model around that, and then finds web slicers have been canned in Internet Explorer version 9, are going to be well pissed at Microsoft, you know, as they were with Vista Ultimate Extras and AdSense, which being canned, which he wrote about this week.
I think it was a really, really gutsy thing for Microsoft to do, to make standards mode the default in IE. I'm really still surprised they did that. They didn't have to. I mean, they could have just kept going on and said, oh, you know, screw everybody out there. We don't care if we support standards. We never have them. We're never going to, you know. They could have said that. So it was very controversial when they said they were going to do it. They did it. I'm still stunned that they did it, and they're going to be paying the price for not having a standards compliant browser before, and it's going to take a long time for people to trust them and to kind of come into the fold that Microsoft's actually doing something that's standards compliant.
Screw everybody out there. That's Microsoft. MJ can be tough on Microsoft. So speaking of tough dilemmas, 22 hours of darkness, the Azure cloud went down at the weekend, a few days before Mix. What happens next? It's, you know, seems to me this cloud thing is totally unreliable. As it turned out, Microsoft blamed the problem on an over-enthusiastic Fabric controller, which is essentially the guts of Microsoft's cloud. It deals with the provisioning and the lifecycle management of the application. Theoretically, it's also supposed to handle secure, safe updates and maintain reliability and availability of applications. Obviously, that didn't work. But according to various blog posts, the Fabric controller went out of control and started taking down all of the instances and tried to reboot all of the servers rather than just dealing with a bunch of servers that had been damaged. You know, is Fabric controller learning? Is it becoming self-aware? Is it going to declare war on the human race next? I don't know. I'm worried.
Oh, Gavin. Okay, I'm going to be soft on Microsoft again here. Because, okay, first I'm going to say, and I know a lot of people are going to say this is a cop-out, but this thing is only in CTP mode, number
one. That's a
cop-out. I know, see. I guess I'm one of those people who I would never trust my real eggs in the Microsoft basket before anything is like a version 3 of a product. So, like when I hear people are saying, hey, the CTP was down for 22 hours, it's like, okay, guys, it's a test build, you know? I mean, and that's not to totally excuse them. I mean, they're trying to build a cloud that's reliable and that people can count on. So this was a very unfortunate thing that happened 22 hours, you know, before Mix or whatever it was, that, you know, something you're going to talk about at Mix in a big way, the Azure cloud goes down and it's like, oh yeah, so I guess it's not really that great. Here at Mix this week, what they announced was they just did the first major refresh to the cloud and the cloud SDK since they announced Azure at the PDC. So, you know, they're adding things to try to make it more resilient and better and more performant and all that stuff that you always hear them talk about. So that's good. I mean, it's good. It's moving ahead. It's still going to ship this year in final form, they're saying. So
I think the one of the smaller points that was interesting, the fact that you can now run PHP applications on it with fast CGI, that's going to be a big thing. And also, they promised other languages support as well. I went to one session that turned out they're going to roll ahead pretty aggressively the next few months with multiple data centers. And yeah, they're going to add that whole bombshell that dropped about putting relational functionality from SQL Server on the cloud broke down a little bit further. It turns out we're going to get the relational functionality with blobs and tables in the next CTP. And after that, we're going to get more kind of actual line of business features going up there, business intelligence and reporting features. So it's getting very OLAP-based functionality and tools-based functionality are going to be going up into that cloud quite well after that. No, there was no dates on that. But what was interesting, maybe, was what happened outside the context of the show, and there was that talk that IBM buying Sun Microsystems, both companies of which have been, IBM has been quietly and consistently building clouds, and Sun has finally articulated something approaching a cloud strategy. But as ever with Sun, shot itself in the foot by allowing this story to get out there that it's going to be bought by IBM. So I think, what do you think here? What does this mean? I mean, I guess the question is, you have two computing giants, very experienced in the server and the data center environment. Microsoft, not very experienced in the server and data center environment, but very experienced on software. You know, what does this, you know, with Sun and IBM potentially teaming up, what does it mean for Microsoft, do you think?
Well, I think it was really interesting to see what Steve Ballmer said this week, what it was going to mean for Microsoft. He was speaking at a McGraw-Hill conference in New York this week, and someone asked him that very question, and he said, wow, we're really hoping it happens because it'll really distract IBM for like a year or two trying to swallow up Sun, and so that's great because IBM's a big competitor of ours, and we'll be glad to see them be distracted, you know. So, you know, typical Steve Ballmer response, right? Like, just like, ha-ha, it's all a joke. I think it's going to be interesting what it could mean for Microsoft. I don't think it's as direct an impact as some people might think, because IBM and Sun, I see more synergies there on the hardware side. I don't really see as many synergies on the software side. I don't see IBM gaining a lot from Sun on software, because I never really considered Sun a software player. I know they consider themselves one.
Haven't you heard they've got an open source strategy?
I mean, you know, they've got the bits and pieces, but I don't think IBM wants them for their software, that's for sure. I don't think it'll be a direct head-to-head impact on Microsoft. I think it's really interesting, though, to see more and more of the companies who've been partners of Microsoft. Like, IBM's actually been a Microsoft partner in terms of, you know, using their software on their hardware. And this week we also saw Cisco, which has kind of been a partner and a competitor to Microsoft, doing a deal to put Windows on some of those new unified servers that they announced, those Blade Center servers that they're going to be selling to people for their own data centers on premise. So we're seeing a lot of shifts in that market, but nothing that's really going to kind of come at Microsoft where it hurts them, which is software and, you know, data center software, data center services. You know, Sun announced some cloud initiative this week too, I guess. I kind of paid very peripheral attention to that, like a lot of people, I think.
I think the biggest takeaway from that Sun announcement, which was overshadowed by the potential IBM deal, was they've now developed a computing APIs and storage APIs, which to me seem very much like the work Amazon's been doing. So it's about 3-4 years behind Amazon. That's not really a great step forward.
Yeah.
What came out of Mix was discussion here that IBM and Microsoft, sorry, is going to do a lot of work around making it easier to spin up virtual instances and provision what it called commodity servers and add virtualization to commodity servers without having to do its own clustering or without having to do its like manual based engineering. Well, for years that's been the kind of like the kind of bailiwick of companies like IBM and Sun, who've got like these Spark non-Intel kind of based servers. So if, you know, and it's a big if, Microsoft does come up with some applied engineering and get some brain power on this thing, well, it can harness the whole move towards commodity center based data centers and maybe offer something to those clouds running on Intel based servers and bring them on a par with Spark or PowerPC or mainframe based data centers. And before you laugh that one, Nicole, remember how people used to think Windows NT was no kind of competitor to Unix, and then it got its act together over like a 5-10 year period. And I think even some of those guys who did that are even working in that cloud fabric now.
Yep, they are. They are. So yeah, things can change pretty quickly in that space, for sure. I'm going to go back to Cisco for a second, because I think that announcement was very interesting this week. And I actually went back and asked Microsoft whether they had considered and whether Cisco had asked them about licensing not just Windows Server, but like maybe Red Dog and putting it on servers and for data center purposes. And Microsoft said, we are not selling Azure to people who want to put it on premise. And, you know, that's been something that I've seen go back and forth. I've seen it reported that Microsoft will allow customers to run Azure on premise. And now they're saying, no, that's not our plan, that, you know, we'll let customers run Windows Server on premise, but we're not going to let them run Azure because that's like our crown jewels and we're running that. And if you want to host your stuff on our cloud, we are not like letting users put that stack of software on a server and put it on premise. We're not doing that. So that's kind of interesting that, you know, we've seen it reported both ways, and it'll be interesting to see when Microsoft does actually announce pricing and partners and the SLA agreements this summer, they say, for Azure, what they actually do end up announcing that people can and can't do.
The partners going to be, as ever, will be crucial in this. Those will be the who do the packaging and the pricing and make sense of what is a very broad and undefined area. On the one hand, you've got this is on storage, for example, Azure tables. Azure Big Table, which is like big mainframe style storage. And on the other hand, you've now got SDS, which is more relational, and you've got a huge area in between those two extremes that's like uncharted territory, and it's going to be up to the pioneers to go out there and set some stakes in the ground around what they can sell around meeting customer needs. So if you're this kind of customer with these kind of needs, then you'll need SDS with maybe a bit of Big Table thrown in. And if you're this kind of customer, then you'll need Big Table with a bit of SDS thrown in. So Microsoft's not really going to – it'll set some best practices. It'll set some kind of high-level thinking. But it's going to come down to the actual partners as ever to actually fill out those gaps and read between the lines and offer something that both Microsoft and they can make money on.
Yep. I think this year's Microsoft Partners Show is going to be very interesting.
Yeah. Last time I went to a partner show, a lot of partners walked out those sessions on cloud, scratching their heads. They couldn't wait to get to the bar or get to the Starbucks. Like there was no, Microsoft would like go, right, got any questions? There were no questions, no hands went up, everyone just fired out and was like, you know, what the fuck?
Yeah, I don't think that it was just because they were running for drinks either. I think a lot of them are really pissed off. As you recall, Microsoft, when they first told the partners about their cloud ambitions, a lot of people were surprised, like, wait, you're getting into our area. Like, we host Exchange, we host, Office Communication Server. Now here you come and you're going to do it. And you're going to also have a cloud play. And like, what happened to us? So they're still, you know, gradually winning over partners too. So they've got a lot of proving ground this partner show to handle.
Okay. Well, Steve Ballmer, he's been on fine form this last few days as ever. I reckon, Steve, before he takes the mic, he must take a few drinks and then just those real cautions to win before he speaks. You know, he must take. So, Steve Ballmer, Moodex, with that in mind, what do you reckon this show, MJ? Frustrated, intense, all business, victorious, or monkey boy? Bear in mind what you were saying, he was at that McGraw-Hill conference.
Yeah, he was at the McGraw-Hill conference and said yet again for the millionth time since last year, we're still interested in doing the Yahoo partnership. Yeah. I guess I'd say all business, maybe. He's still in the fighting mood. You know, he's still out there slashing at Apple and slashing at, you know, IBM and everybody else like he always does, throwing like bombs out there. But I think Ballmer has got to be very subdued and very realistic right now with the state of the economy. People aren't really buying. Microsoft having to drop prices of software assurance contracts. I mean, there's a lot of pressure on Microsoft right now, and not just to like come out with the next new thing, but actually to be able to sell the things they've already got out there.
Yeah, I mean, these are tough times for any tech company. And I think it's interesting. I've certainly seen more coming out of Microsoft in terms of willingness to negotiate and lower its prices and retain customers than I've seen from some of the other big enterprise software companies, namely Oracle and SAP, that I'm not aware of, have lowered their prices and pretty much held consistently. And Oracle, I think, always willing to negotiate on a case-by-case basis. But I've spoken to a lot of customers who have just had enough of Oracle and they're turning to open source. I think Microsoft is very aware of the fact that it could lose people very easily in the next months and year or so to Linux and open source, and it's adjusting its prices accordingly. So I think Steve-O's all business. He knows, you know, yeah, pot shots at Apple for, you know, $500 for a logo, but, you know, let's get down to cases. People are going to buy Apple, you know, because they like it. Nobody loves Apple. Nobody loves Microsoft, and it knows it's got to convince people. It's got to justify, I think, its presence more so than Apple has in terms of business.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree. So that wraps up another show, Gavin.
Another one, and with the sounds of Halo and Halo 3 and Gears of War winding down behind us, I think that does it for Mix this year.
Yep. Well, this has been Mary Jo Foley with All About Microsoft.
And this is Gavin Clark, software editor for The Register. And this has been MicBite, brought to you by the people who bite the hand that feeds IT.